Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The Atlantic Coast Natural Gas Pipeline has been the subject of conversation and of this program for years. As planned, the pipeline would follow a 600-mile path from West Virginia into and through Virginia and North Carolina, carrying 1.5 billion cubic feet of natural gas every day to about 5 million homes. Proponents say its construction would create 17,000 jobs and $28 million in property taxes each year that would buoy the counties through which it passes, many of them in dire financial need. But opponents, environmentalists, say the pipeline is a danger to the pristine areas through which it will pass, including a portion of the Appalachian Trail. And there are other arguments as well. Those arguments continue, even though construction began in West Virginia in May of 2018. So this hour, we'll hear both sides of this argument. Later in the program, we'll hear from a representative of Dominion Energy. They, along with Duke Energy, Piedmont Natural Gas, and others, are stakeholders in the project. We'll also hear from a proponent of the pipeline from an economic development point of view in one of the communities that will be impacted by this pipeline. But we start with a conversation with a reporter who has been covering this for years. Lindsay Gilpin has traveled the route, trudged through cow pastures, and climbed ridges to report on the pipeline's impact. She's editor-in-chief of Southerly, whose investigative piece, A Pipeline, runs through it. It was recently published in Grist and Biographic. Her work has also appeared in The Washington Post, The Atlantic, and Harper's. Good morning, and thank you for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You're welcome. So, though this pipeline will run for 600 miles between West Virginia and the coastal areas of North Carolina, this is not the only pipeline carrying fossil fuels traveling long distances in the United States. Were those other projects as controversial as this one appears to be?
In a way, yes. They have been as controversial or close to, I guess. The biggest one is the Mountain Valley Pipeline, which runs pretty much parallel to the Atlantic Coast Pipeline for about 300 miles, which is, you know, half of the length. But there's a kind of a glut of proposed or in-progress pipelines in Appalachia, starting in the Marcellus Shale region of northern West Virginia and heading south through the steep, dense Appalachian mountains. And so that's sort of been the major focus of a lot of groups, organizations, activists, advocates, landowners, and other stakeholders in the region that have been trying to figure out, is this a viable economic plan? Because it seems to many people that I spoke to in my reporting over the last couple of years that a lot of them are concerned that it's sort of the next iteration of the coal industry in Appalachia. The natural gas boom is an extractive industry just like coal, and so a lot of people are concerned that it's sort of going to have the same boom and bust cycle and not offer the benefits that have been promised by developers.
So there are a lot of concerns surrounding this Atlantic Coast Pipeline, some of them environmental, some of them economic, some of them social. But what has been the track record of these other pipelines? Have any of the dire warnings about the Atlantic Coast Pipeline come to fruition in these other pipelines?
Well, the Mountain Valley Pipeline is the one that most immediately comes to mind, and that the construction on that pipeline is almost complete. The number that I got from the Southern Environmental Law Center was, or some other people, were at 90% complete-ish. And so that's far more complete. The Atlantic Coast Pipeline is only 6% complete. So a lot of people say that because of the intense focus on the impacts and the environmental violations and everything, that people are really keeping watch on the Atlantic Coast Pipeline. It's actually been done better in a lot of areas, particularly in West Virginia, because that's where most of the construction was. The Mountain Valley Pipeline, on the other hand, has seen a host of water violations, water quality violations, of environmental violations, including sedimentation and other erosion issues, things like that. And so that, and also concerns over endangered species in the way, and problems with, people are concerned with flooding because of the erosion problems that I just mentioned. And so There have been a lot of issues with the Mountain Valley Pipeline, and that sort of has provided some evidence that the Atlantic Coast Pipeline might cause a lot of the same similar problems, at least especially because it's twice as long.
So did those problems crop up specifically during construction, or are they ongoing problems when the pipelines are up and operating?
Well, most of these that we're talking about are during construction. And, you know, the construction of these pipelines has taken a long time because it's gotten held up in the courts. So there's been a lot of stop and start nature in all three of the states, West Virginia and Virginia and North Carolina. And but there are concerns with issues once the pipe is in the ground and would be up and running. Obviously, neither of these are up and running yet. Hmm. But the concern is that there could be natural gas leaks, that it would leak methane. There's, you know, research to show that that can happen. There's problems with concerns about the compressor stations that help transport the natural gas that are placed kind of periodically along the route. And the other thing is just issues with destruction of natural habitat and the during construction, and also issues with explosions and danger to water quality while the pipeline is in operation.
You say in the course of your reporting, and I'm not sure exactly, well, how long have you been looking into this? Let's talk about that first. How long have you been looking into this problem?
I started looking at this probably the beginning of 2018. Had been sort of following it before, but started this particular story, researching it in 2018. Did most of my reporting in November 2018, which was about a month before construction was halted on the Atlantic Coast Pipeline because of the AT crossing.
And in the course of talking to all the people that you've spoken to in the course of your reporting, you said that you discovered that the pipeline, quote, has pitted neighbor against neighbor and sibling against sibling. It has split church communities and broken friendships. But it has also caused some to really delve into the particulars of this project and become civically involved in the process. Have you also witnessed those who became involved become advocates for this project?
Yeah, you know, I think the biggest thing I came away with from this reporting and the reason that this story was such an in-depth project, you know, with kind of showing pieces of different communities along the route and the various issues that they're dealing with, is because it's not simple. It's not economic boom versus save the environment. It's not environmentalists versus pro-business people or energy industry people. It's very, very incredibly complicated. And like you mentioned, it's broken up families. You know, I met people that don't speak to their brother because one is for the pipeline and one is against it. Hmm. And I think that is the most important thing to realize, is that it's not a simple issue. You know, it's not just the fact that some people want economic development and some people want to protect the environment. The problems that I've seen and sort of the reasons that it's complex is because there are a lot of ways that Dominion and Duke have gone about constructing this pipeline and approaching landowners and getting the permits that have frustrated a lot of people and have caused problems, and that we've seen the courts validate, right, by vacating some of these permits. And so I think I really want to stress that point, that it's not, like us versus them. In a lot of cases in these communities, you see landowners who are, very conservative and pro-energy projects have it come across their property or their son's property or their neighbor's property and say, I don't want the pipeline that close to my house. This is dangerous, and sort of change. And you see a lot of people that have really stood behind the workers that are working these temporary construction jobs and say, like, we support these workers. We know that they need a job. These are places that are financially struggling. These are places that are affected by the downturn, the sharp, sharp downturn of coal in Appalachia. But at the same time, that's not helping create a permanent, sustainable economy in these communities, in these rural communities that really need it. So you see,
so
there's a lot of nuance in there.
There are environmental concerns, which I'm sure we'll spend a lot of time talking about as we go through this hour today, but there's also other concerns that don't get mentioned as much. In your reporting, you say that the route of this pipeline divides historic African-American communities and goes through land owned by indigenous populations. You followed its route through family cemeteries, in fact. That would certainly be upsetting to a lot of loved ones. How was the route determined, and was there no way to move the pipeline to avoid those areas?
Well, the route was changed a lot of times because of various issues, including endangered species. I spoke to a Dominion representative for the story, and I think she said there were like 300 route changes in total, and you know there were thousands and thousands of comments on the proposed route because it does go through so many private landowners' properties, and it does cut through 25 counties, a couple of cities, and so smaller cities but cities, and because of this, there's a lot of issues with like who owns what property and who how many family owners get a say and what happens. And so I think that that part of it is really important to remember that this depends a lot on individual landowners. And however, like in North Carolina, 7 of the 8 counties it goes through are predominantly African American. And you know, a lot of folks that I spoke to and some research shows, right, that there are more air pollutant emitters cited in African American communities in Carolina and across the country. And so there's a lot of environmental justice concerns with that too. In addition, there's just because it's a rural area, I spoke to the Pipeline Safety Trust, which advocates for pipeline safety at the federal level. And they told me that, you know, it's easier to build pipelines in rural areas because there are less people. And there's less regulation. You don't have to go through as many hoops as you would in a more urban setting, even if it is a smaller town. And so that is one of the reasons that these companies cite some these projects in rural communities.
So let me ask you.
Of money and don't have a lot of power to sort of fight back legally, for instance.
Let me ask a question that requires a really short answer. Is most of this pipeline, once it's constructed, going to be underground?
Yeah.
Okay, so once the construction disruption is over, people won't even see this thing. Is that right?
Well, they won't see the pipeline, but there are compressor stations and the headquarters, and there are also all of the land that has been cleared, things that have been sort of taken down, whether it's trees or houses or whatever it might be to get out of the way.
And you mentioned that people are concerned because in some cases the pipeline would be close to their house. And certainly we know from areas in the Northeast where natural gas supplies heating and cooking fuel to a lot of homes and the infrastructure underground is pretty darned old, that there have been explosions along the way. But this would be new. Have other 42-inch or larger pipelines experienced explosions or leaks?
I'm not sure about the 42 inches. I know that there are at least a few 42-inch pipelines in the ground. I don't think there's one proposedly or is in the ground that's this long, that's 600 miles long. But it really is. I mean, yes, the aging infrastructure is a big deal, and that is the reason for a lot of the leaks. But it's not just that. Like, pipelines leak no matter what. They leak methane. There are the potential of explosions no matter how new or old they are. So I think that's definitely worth noting, that there's research to show that that's the case. And then you have the compressor stations, like I mentioned, which a lot of the Northampton County, North Carolina, for instance, people are concerned about the risks associated to a compressor station and the new.
Right. Lindsay Gilpin is editor-in-chief of Southerly. Her article, A Pipeline Runs Through It, is fairly exhaustive when it comes to talking to people pro and con. We'll continue our conversation in just a moment. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Lindsay Gilpin is with us. She's editor-in-chief of Southerly and the author of A Pipeline Runs Through It. She wrote that for Grist and Biograph. Her material has also been in the pages of The Washington Post, The Atlantic, and Harper's. The Atlantic Coast Pipeline is what we're talking about. It's a joint venture among Dominion Energy, Duke Energy, Piedmont Natural Gas, and Southern Company Gas. Dominion Energy, however, is the lead stakeholder, and joining us now to share their perspective is Dominion Energy's Aaron Ruby. He also joins us by phone. Good morning. Thank you for being here.
Good morning, Mike. Thanks for having me on, and good morning, Lindsay.
Hi, Aaron.
This pipeline was originally approved originally by the Obama administration and has become one of the priority infrastructure projects of the Trump administration. So we have bipartisan support here. It was initially approved in 2013 by the Obama administration after Dominion Transmission asked permission to export natural gas to Japan and India. So is the purpose, Aaron, of this pipeline to carry natural gas to the coast for export? Or is it to provide natural gas to people in Virginia, West Virginia, and North Carolina? What's the real purpose here?
Well, so that's a good question, Mike, and I appreciate you having me on. So I think you're actually confusing two separate Dominion Energy projects. So
okay. A
few years ago, we built a liquefied natural gas or LNG export facility in Maryland, and that does export clean LNG to India and Japan so that they can decarbonize their economies. Those countries are largely reliant on oil, coal, and other higher carbon energy sources. And so we provide them cleaner natural gas, which produces half the carbon emissions of coal, one-third fewer carbon emissions than oil. So that facility is very important in terms of combating global climate change on a global scale.
But is that really true? Because methane is the leading problem with climate change, and that's what natural gas is.
Well, that's actually not true. So carbon emissions is the largest source of greenhouse gas emissions in the atmosphere. But in any event, the Atlantic Coast Pipeline is a totally separate project. All of the natural gas that's transported through the Atlantic Coast Pipeline is going to generate electricity, provide home heating, and power businesses in Virginia and North Carolina. So all of the gas is contracted by public utilities that serve millions of homes and businesses in Virginia and North Carolina.
Okay.
Utilities like Duke Energy, which will use the natural gas to generate cleaner electricity, Piedmont Natural Gas that will use the natural gas to heat people's homes and their water and to power manufacturing. So really, Mike, what this project is all about is about building a better economic and environmental future for our region in North Carolina and Virginia, and also improving our environment. And the reason is natural gas is an essential part of the clean energy future and the low carbon future that we're trying to build in our region. And it's for two reasons. Number one, and I think as you've talked about in previous broadcasts, natural gas has allowed our region to shift away from coal. Natural gas produces half the carbon emissions of coal, 80 to 90% less sulfur and nitrogen. So natural gas is a much cleaner alternative. Secondly, natural gas is an essential partner for renewables, and it is allowing us and will continue to allow us in our region to rapidly expand the use of solar and offshore wind.
So, this project has been controversial from the beginning, and I'm curious about whether or not you anticipated these controversies. And is part of the reason for the controversy now that natural gas was being pitched as a bridge fuel to take us from coal to renewables, clean renewables, and now clean renewables like wind and solar in some areas, and certainly in North Carolina, are becoming almost as cheap as natural gas?
Well, so you're right in observing that, Mike. So North Carolina is the second largest solar producing state in the country, and Dominion Energy, our company, we're the fourth largest solar operator in the country. We have the fourth largest solar fleet, and we have plans to dramatically expand the amount of solar that we're developing in Virginia over the next several years. We're also building the largest offshore wind project in the entire country off the coast of Virginia. So in Virginia and in North Carolina, Dominion Energy, Duke Energy, we're all in on renewables. We are rapidly expanding renewables as fast as we can. But natural gas, we can't do that without natural gas, because renewables aren't always reliable when we need electricity. So, and you've talked about this in previous broadcasts, that wind and solar are only producing electricity about 25 or 35% of the day. And the American economy, the daily lives of Americans, we depend on reliable energy 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Natural gas provides the reliable source of energy that we need to keep the lights on and to keep the economy running when solar and wind aren't producing electricity. So the two go hand in hand. So I think it's actually a bit of a misnomer when people say that natural gas is a bridge from coal to renewables. It's actually an essential partner for the renewable future that we're building.
So yeah, as I mentioned earlier, go ahead, Lindsay, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm actually curious because Dominion's own, most scenarios in Dominion's long-term energy plan shows no increase in regional natural gas consumption through 2033. And I think it's also important to note that, like Aaron just said, Dominion and Duke are the majority owners of this project, and they're also the customers. So under federal law, they're allowed a 14% return on that project, which they can then charge their ratepayers for. So I'm curious if that is part of the plan, because there's a lot of concern that I've seen in my reporting that's what's going to happen, and that's why a lot of people are upset. So I'd love to hear you talk a little bit about that.
Well, I appreciate the question, Lindsay, and that is a question that we get a lot. So I'll try to unpack that a little bit at a very high level. In a market economy, consumers pay all of the costs that are associated with producing and transporting the goods that they buy. And that's not unique to energy. So that's true for every consumer product that you purchase in our economy. So when you, let's say, purchase an iPhone, baked into the cost of that iPhone is the cost of the raw materials, the production costs for making the iPhone, the labor costs of the people that made it, and also the transportation costs for bringing that iPhone to the store where you bought it or to your home. The same is true for energy. So when you get your electric or gas bill, included in that bill is the cost of all of the infrastructure that it took to make the energy that you use and all of the infrastructure it took to transport that energy to your home or business. And so if it's gas, that's going to mean you're paying for the cost of the gas. You're paying for the pipeline infrastructure that transported to your home. If it's electricity, you're paying for the fuel that was used to generate the electricity. You're paying for the power plants that produced it and all of the transmission and distribution wires that brought it to your home.
Right. So that, Dominion doesn't expect an increase in natural gas in most scenarios until 2033, then why do people need to pay for this? I think is the biggest question.
Well, so that's actually, I don't think that's the case. So I think what you're talking about is a integrated resource plan that we file every couple of years where we forecast into the future multiple different scenarios, maybe half a dozen different scenarios of what we think, you know, in a moment in time, what the future energy demand and needs will be. And I think you're pointing to just a couple of those scenarios. But there certainly are scenarios that we projected where we will need additional natural gas electricity generation, particularly because of the significant amount of solar and offshore wind that we're building. And in fact, we've just announced recently a couple of new smaller natural gas peaking plants that we're building in conjunction with solar projects. Basically, when you build large-scale solar projects, you're also going to build natural gas combustion turbines because natural gas is the only source of energy that is easily, we call it dispatchable. Basically, within a moment's notice, when a solar facility comes offline because the sun goes behind the clouds or when a wind facility goes offline because the wind isn't blowing, you can very quickly power up a natural gas plant in order to stabilize the grid and keep the lights on. And so as I was describing earlier, you know, we do see a very strong future for natural gas in Virginia and North Carolina and across the country as we continue to transition to renewables.
So one of the concerns that has been brought up frequently about this is the fact that this natural gas pipeline will cross the Appalachian Trail. People object to that just because the Appalachian Trail is one of those things that they want to keep as pristine as possible. But you say, Aaron, that hundreds of other pipelines already cross the trail. That's true? Is that true? And have there ever been problems with those pipelines?
Well, that is true, Mike. So for many decades, under Republican and Democratic administrations alike, hundreds of pipelines and electric transmission lines have been permitted to safely cross the Appalachian Trail, and they haven't disturbed its use, and the Atlantic Coast Pipeline will be no different. So, you know, currently today, there are about 226 crossings of the Appalachian Trail by electric transmission lines, natural gas pipelines, and other energy fuel pipelines, and they haven't disturbed its public use, and neither will the Atlantic Coast Pipeline. And in fact, to avoid any impacts to the Appalachian Trail, we will be installing the pipeline through a tunnel that's more than 700 feet below the Appalachian Trail, and it will be installed more than a half mile on both sides of the Appalachian Trail. So construction of the pipeline won't disturb the use of the Appalachian Trail. People will be hiking along the section of the trail where we're building the pipeline. They won't see the construction. They won't hear it. They won't know it's occurring. And it won't, you know, because of the method that we're using, we also don't have to clear trees within a half mile on either side of the okay. Appalachian Trail. So we've actually... Oh, go ahead.
Another concern is the damage it may do during construction, certainly, not necessarily just along the Appalachian Trail, but elsewhere, and afterwards, the damage it may do afterwards because of potentials for leaks and explosions. And Lindsay reports that, according to Carl Weimer, executive director of the Pipeline Safety Trust, which advocates for pipeline safety regulations, those regulations are generally less stringent governing pipelines running through rural areas. And according to Dominion Energy, once the pipeline becomes operational, quote, a few dozen inspectors and technicians will be employed to maintain it. This is 600 miles. Is that enough people?
Well, first of all, I'll say that, you know, pipeline safety is our top priority as a company, and natural gas pipelines are by far the safest form of energy transportation in the country. In fact, more than 99.9% of all the natural gas that's transported through our nation's pipeline system is delivered safely to its end destination without incident. And the reason that is because of the redundant overlapping layers of protection that we employ at every stage of the pipeline's development, both during construction and then once it's in operation. And so once it's in service, once the pipeline is operational, it's actually monitored 24/7, 365 days a year from our gas control center in West Virginia. And we have remote sensors that are placed along the entire length of the pipeline. And what those sensors are monitoring is the pressure, the temperature, the flow of the gas in all times and in real time. And those sensors can detect even the slightest variations in any of those measurements to let us know if there is a problem that needs to be addressed. And we have remote control safety shutoff valves placed along the entire length of the pipeline. So that if we detect an abnormal variation in any of those measurements that lets us know that there is an issue with the pipeline that we need to address, we can immediately and remotely shut off that section of the pipeline so that we can take corrective action and prevent it from becoming a risk to public safety.
What's the physical pipe made out of?
So this is steel. And in fact, that's another one of the inherent layers of defense against corrosion or other external damage to the pipeline. It's going to be built with half an inch to almost 1 inch thick carbon steel, which is an incredibly durable material. And then it's also... Go ahead.
But the Southern Environmental Law Center says you had to dig up 10 miles of pipe in West Virginia because it failed a corrosion test. How would corrosion impact a pipeline 700 feet below the Appalachian Trail?
Well, so
corrosion was because of a coating that's on the pipeline, coating that's manufactured by chemical company 3M. And that coating has, that 3M even says that has been shown with, there's ultraviolet light, you know, sun rays or exposure to the elements, it can cause cancer-causing chemicals to leak from it or to come out of it. And so that a lot of these pipes have been sitting for years because this pipeline has been in limbo for so long. And so that's the corrosion issues. The companies were ordered to look further into these corrosion issues as well with this coating.
So, Lindsay, so Aaron, has that been handled?
Well, so I think Lindsay is talking about two issues, and I remember seeing this in our article. So the issue that you raised, Mike, which was also in Lindsay's report, where we had to excavate about 10 miles of pipe in West Virginia, in Lindsay's story, she said that was because it failed a corrosion test, which is not correct. So, in fact, what we did was, we were under construction for about a year. And then in late 2018, because of the Appalachian Trail crossing permit and the Fish and Wildlife Service permit getting vacated by a federal court, we had to halt construction. And so what we did out of an abundance of caution is we installed what's known as cathodic protection, which is actually a corrosion protection technology. Now, typically, you install cathodic protection on a pipeline once the entire pipeline is complete. But out of an abundance of caution, we weren't required to do this, but we thought it was the right thing to do. We excavated some of the pipe and installed temporary cathodic protection to make sure that the pipe was not corroding while we were temporarily halted with construction. So I think the way that maybe the Southern Environmental Law Center presented it and the way that it was characterized in the article was inaccurate, as if the pipe was corroding when the opposite was the case. We were actually going out of our way to make sure that the pipe did not corrode and had all of the protections necessary so that it didn't corrode while we were temporarily halted with construction.
I have 30 seconds left in this segment. Yesterday, the New York Times reported on Bellingham, Washington, whose city council is considering adopting a ban on all residential heating by natural gas because natural gas, they say, contributes to greenhouse gases. Last year, Berkeley, California, became the first city in the country to ban natural gas in newly constructed residential buildings. Is this something that the industry is concerned about? Very quickly. Very quickly.
It is something we're concerned about, but I think we're... if what you see happening, and this was in the New York Times article about Bellingham, right. There is a large coalition of people that are speaking out against these really
and with
extreme...
That I have to stop at Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
I'm Lisa Wharf.
And I'm Steve Harrison.
This August, Charlotte will host the Republican National Convention, which brings up a number of questions.
Why did Charlotte bid on the RNC, and how will it impact the city? And yes, that means you.
Launching January 23rd, Inside Politics, WFAE's new podcast hosted by us.
Where we cover the RNC and the 2020 election through the lens of Charlotte.
Subscribe to the Inside Politics podcast now on wfae.org/insidepolitics.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Lindsay Gilpin is the author of A Pipeline Runs Through It, an article talking about the history of the controversy surrounding the route of the Atlantic Coast Pipeline from West Virginia through Virginia into North Carolina. Aaron Ruby still with us. He's with Dominion Energy, which is the lead stakeholder in all of this. Just a couple more questions, Mr. Ruby. The pipeline has faced a lot of legal challenges over the years, and the Supreme Court has decided to take your case, and will hear oral arguments in February with a final decision on at least this one case expected in June here. What's at stake for Dominion and Duke and Piedmont and others?
Well, I appreciate the question, Mike. Do you mind if I finish addressing the last
sure.
one that we were talking
sure.
about just before we went to the break?
Sure.
So I think you have seen some cities and towns that have started to pass resolutions either banning the installation of new natural gas appliances in homes or businesses. In the case of Bellingham, Washington, it was the most extreme that I've seen, where it appeared that they are considering an ordinance that would ban existing natural gas appliances in homes or businesses. And I just want to put this in context very quickly, and it also relates to the Atlantic Coast Pipeline. Half of all Americans use natural gas to heat their homes, cook their food, heat their water, and power other household appliances. That's more than 180 million Americans. Natural gas generates one-third of our nation's electricity, and it is also an essential energy source and a raw ingredient for America's manufacturing. So it is the natural gas is the only way that you can generate the heat necessary to melt, dry, bake, or glaze all kinds of different products that we all use every day, whether it's glass, ceramics, bricks, paper. And then it also, it's a raw ingredient for most of the plastic and polymer products that we use every day. So natural gas plays a vitally important role in most aspects of the daily lives of all Americans. And so I think that's why you're seeing a broad coalition of stakeholders across the board speaking out against some of these more radical proposals in some of the cities.
So at last report, I have to move on because I've got another guest coming on. So at last report, Dominion Energy expects the pipeline to be up and running by 2021. Does that target date remain realistic given the fact that the Supreme Court won't even rule on one of these cases until June?
It does. It does. So we're confident that we'll be able to resume construction this summer and be able to complete the project by late 2021 and have it fully in service by early 22.
Aaron Ruby is with Dominion Energy, and I know that one of the things that you wanted to talk about was that there are people and communities and organizations throughout North Carolina, Virginia, and West Virginia who are in support of this. And now we're going to bring, and I want to thank you for being on the program, Aaron, but we're going to bring on somebody now who is one of those people who is in favor of this because of the economic opportunity the pipeline might provide. Again, construction would create 17,000 jobs, and proponents point to the $28 million each year of property taxes that will allegedly be generated in the counties through which the pipeline will pass. And some of those counties are in dire economic straits. They can use the money. Robert Van Giens is president and CEO of the Fayetteville-Cumberland Economic Development Corporation. Think of them as Charlotte Center City Partners for Fayetteville. He joins us now to talk about the economic positives of this project. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Your job and that of your organization is to attract new residents, new businesses, and tourists to your area of the state. How does the pipeline figure into that?
Well, thank you. Yeah, I guess maybe it's a bit of a distinction, but I'm not pro-pipeline. I look at this only as I'm pro-economic opportunity for our community.
Okay.
And I think that, you know, beyond the direct jobs and taxes paid, which we've talked about and Lindsay's articles cover, this project would provide us the infrastructure that we lack. We lack the capacity, the energy security to grow our local economy. We are here in Fayetteville. We're the sixth largest city in the Carolinas. We're a community of 350,000 people. But today, whether it's a plastic manufacturer or a food processor or an advanced technology company, we can't guarantee them the service they need during a cold snap or period of high residential demand. We've got the world's largest military installation by population with Fort Bragg. If they need backup generation, we don't have the capacity. So for us, it's the having the ability to bring those companies and investments that create jobs and evolve our local economy.
So as I understand, your answer, this is a great need for you. You cannot grow because you can't supply the needs you already have without this pipeline. Is that accurate?
That is. I mean, we're on the far end of the infrastructure that runs through the Charlotte region. So any disruption puts our residents and our businesses in jeopardy. And honestly, this project would provide our state redundancy with regards to natural gas. And if you just look where development has happened with investment from production, from companies that bring jobs, it has occurred along these major pipelines. Now, it is not the answer for us, but successful economic development happens where you have the talent, where you have the logistical infrastructure, but also where you have the capacity with regards to water, sewer, and other utilities. And we're missing this critical piece, which severely limits what we're able to do and who we're able to bring here.
So one of the other economic benefits that is pointed to by communities throughout the route of this pipeline is not just the 17,000 jobs that the construction is providing, but also the millions of dollars.
Can I jump in on the 17,000 jobs thing? Because that's not quite accurate. I mean, Dominion says 17,000 jobs, so I think we need to make sure that's what the company says. But as we mentioned before, and as the story mentioned, a few dozen inspectors and technicians are expected for the 600-mile route, which is one interview that a student in West Virginia, at West Virginia University, did a couple years ago. I think the number was like 20. So, and a lot of the construction jobs that we're talking about are done from from out-of-state workers, a lot of the communities that I was in. And I'd actually like to hear more about this about Cumberland County. A lot of them have come in from us because it's higher-level jobs like welders or technicians, things like that. So not a ton of local people are being employed
actually,
by the pipeline.
I'm sorry. They actually are committed to and providing training opportunities. And while those jobs may be temporary during the construction project, our citizens who partake in that, who gain those skills, can transfer them to other jobs. And again, more importantly, it's not about the project directly. It's about all the other projects that we're able to compete for and win based on what the assets we have in this region that we just can't without this infrastructure.
So aside from the jobs that are temporary or not that are being created by this and the economic benefit that goes along with that, there's been talk of the millions of dollars in property taxes that these counties that to which this pipeline will pass will collect. How much money will Cumberland County collect, do you think, from property taxes on this pipeline?
You know, Mike, I wish I had that right in front of me, and we do have those projections, and it's available on the project's website. But I'll tell you that while that is a good thing, and it'll pay for schools and public services, it's the companies that we've talked to and that we have that we're going after that would come along with it that would exponentially increase that impact. It's a good project for us from a tax base, but I don't look at it as a standalone project. If that was the only benefit it brought, we'd be looking at it probably differently. But because it allows us to round out our portfolio and take a comprehensive push towards economic innovation here, that's why we want the project here. So it's all the other projects that can come with it that we can accommodate here that will really change our tax base and provide the thousands of jobs our citizens need and deserve.
So
I think,
Lindsay,
Robert, you make a really good point, if you don't mind if I jump in here for a second.
Go ahead.
I think that's a good point that rural communities in eastern North Carolina, in West Virginia, in Virginia, need sustainable economic development. I mean, it's not most of them are struggling to find industries to come in, and there are no other industries besides a lot of times extractive ones that are proposing these huge projects that sound, really great when they're proposed at the city council meeting or whatever. And so I think it is an important point to note that we can't just look at energy projects in a silo. It has to do with development in rural communities in general. And that's what I found. I mentioned it earlier about the complexity of this issue is that there are many ways we can improve how we develop rural communities and make sure that's sustainable, that people there are making money and building wealth and kind of moving forward. And so that's where a lot of, I think, the tension in these issues comes from. And I think that can be done better, by journalists when we're reporting on these issues to show how complex they are.
And Lindsay, maybe if I could, I'd just say that's one of my disappointments in this, the overall argument in this. I wish that those who were opposing it were talking about making this project better, about requiring dedication to innovation in next-generation technologies. You're not going to find a bigger proponent for sustainable and renewable energy than I am, but we need to be able to make that happen here in our community where our citizens live. And if it's an all-or-nothing conversation, it's just something that our Cumberland County and our whole region shouldn't be left out of the economic growth of North Carolina.
Well, Governor Cooper has declared that North Carolina would try to reduce its greenhouse emissions by 40% by 2025 compared to 2005 levels, and that can most quickly be accomplished by replacing coal and gas power plants with wind and solar. And there are those who say that the wind and solar industries are creating jobs and economic opportunity wherever they roll out with critical mass. Could Cumberland County, could Fayetteville meet your economic goals and your energy goals by getting more wind and solar as opposed to natural gas?
We have had massive investment in solar here, and I am all for that. Unfortunately, the technology isn't there yet to where we have the battery storage and we have the ability to deliver the raw capacity of energy manufacturing needs. And the other side of it is it comes back to security. And so it can be and should be part of an evolution, not just for the next 10 years, but for the next 100 years and for our great-grandchildren. But natural gas is the most nimble fuel source we have right now, and it also is the one that provides the most efficient energy needed for those energy-intensive operations. I absolutely would love to see our community be where that hybrid starts to happen, where these next-generation deployments of wind, solar, storage, microgrid, and energy management take place, but the reality is our citizens heat their homes on it. Our companies need it. And if you, again, if you look at where we're seeing that investment and growth in North Carolina, it's along these corridors that have the full complement of infrastructure. And so I hope that we as a nation and as a world ease off of our fossil fuels and eventually make it all work with renewables. But we shouldn't have to sit here and watch the national economy go past our citizens and watch our youth go elsewhere for employment now, when this is the best way that we can get to that sustainable future by using natural gas, which is such a nimble source.
Lindsay, some proponents point to the benefits of lower energy costs that will come as a result of this pipeline bringing more natural gas to certain areas. They say that low-income households spend a larger portion of their income on home energy costs than other households, sometimes forgoing food and medicine and other necessities to pay their energy bill. Is this pipeline, in fact, likely to lower costs for consumers?
Theoretically, yes. I've reached out to Dominion many, many times and asked them questions about this, and never got a straight answer about the fact that, you know, who is this energy for? Like, the 5 million households, a number that is in the story is an equivalent. It's not what Dominion said, or it's not exactly what this may be. So it's not clear if the ratepayers of Dominion and Duke would be paying, fees for paying for this infrastructure and not getting access to cheaper natural gas from it, especially because Dominion doesn't expect in a lot of scenarios to see natural gas demand increase in the region. So I think that's a little unclear at this point and part of the problem, right, that a lot of people and communities aren't told sort of the context of this situation and what kind of demand looks like in the region and where we're moving towards. And a lot of their questions haven't been answered, so there's a lot of confusion around that.
I think, Mike, to that point, I've got communities here with 20% poverty rates, and extending natural gas service to them currently is just not feasible because we just don't have the ability to add additional customers without the infrastructure and the capacity available to serve them. So it's not even an option for many of our rural communities here.
There also seems to be a question about whether or not this pipeline will actually produce ongoing jobs, ongoing job creation. The pipeline itself conducted a study in 2014 which touted the cost savings that will allegedly be experienced by businesses. And because of that savings, additional jobs would come from this. But an analysis of that study by Synapse Energy Economics, which was commissioned by the Southern Environmental Law Center, concludes that that expectation was not supported by the evidence. What are you anticipating as a result of greater availability of natural gas in your area and perhaps lower costs?
I think lower costs would be great for our companies and when we compete against other states and other regions for economic development projects. But here in Fayetteville, we are one of the youngest communities in the state. We're also one of the most affordable from housing to also the average cost per skill set of worker. And with that, we have a very effective recruitment package right until we talk to a company that has a high natural gas or high energy demand need. And so that changes the paradigm and opens up entire sectors of the economy, making us a preferred destination with that infrastructure in place. Without it, we are constantly playing catch-up against better-equipped locations, because we are forcing these companies, if they're looking at us, to choose an alternate and more expensive fuel source.
There's a case, Lindsay, before the Supreme Court right now, which will be heard in February and decided in June. And I just asked a few minutes ago Aaron Ruby with Dominion Energy if he thought that their 2021 timeline for completion and operation of this pipeline was still realistic. He said, yes, it is. When do you think all this might be resolved so that we will know whether this project will be completed or if it's, in fact, dead in the water? And I have less than 15 seconds.
I wish I knew, but whatever the Supreme Court rules, the Dominion will still have to get new permits from the Army Corps, the Fish and Wildlife Service, and the Forest Service. So it could be months or years, I think, depending on how all of that goes.
Lindsay Gilpin is editor-in-chief of Southerly. Her article, A Pipeline Runs Through It, was in Grist and Biographic. Robert Van Gians is president and CEO of the Fayetteville-Cumberland Economic Development Corporation. And earlier we heard from Aaron Ruby with Dominion Energy. Thank you all for the hour. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.